You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, my guest is Kathy Acker, and I'm very happy to have her here because I've been reading her for years. I think the first time I encountered her work, I was in the 8th Street bookstore, now burned down, and I found a copy of The Childlike Life of the Black Tarantula, and I've been reading her ever since. These books have gone from their limited press editions to major presses, published first in large version by Grove and now by Pantheon. The most recent collection is Portrait of an Eye, which consists of three of her early works, and Pantheon is also published in paperback, her recent novel In Memoriam to Identity. Well, let's begin. I noticed that In Memoriam to Identity takes many of its themes from Faulkner's Wild Palms.
Right. It takes it from three different Faulkner books, actually.
And Wild Palms is itself a book that alternates between two completely different stories, juxtaposing them. And that seems to be juxtaposition, fragmentalization, the context your work takes place in. Could you talk a bit about that?
Sure. Not when I started to write, but when I started to write as more than, I don't know what, I'd say a student, but a sort of eager, young, open-mouthed, fish-mouthed female. My first model was William Burroughs, because I was in the poetry scene that time, and I was looking for prose writing that had the same authenticity, if I can use that word, as the poetry scene. And I only had two models of larger authors, not only larger in who read them, but larger in scope, larger in endeavor, and that was Kerouac and Burroughs. And Kerouac never appealed to me. I'm not much of that non-conceptual, right-off-the-cuff school. Whereas Burroughs, the carefulness of his thought about the political situation and about the place of language in the political situation absolutely fascinated me. So Burroughs became my first novel, and as a friend of mine recently said, his concern with the gaps, with what happens in between the cut-up, where the non-programming shines through, is what's most important. So I've always, and for other reasons, you know, coming from Dada and surrealism through Pound and all that stuff, been fascinated with gaps.
Well, it also seems that in addition to in reinventing the spaces between elements in a collage, that meaning is gradually shredded. But what one of the things that's fascinated me is that you seem to be, in a kind of Mallarmé sense, reinventing the book, so that when Great Expectations by Kathy Acker appears, or Don Quixote by Kathy Acker, with a confected quote from Robespierre, for instance, there's a whole sense in which what you're looking at is something other than a book, an imitation book, a simulation book, a spurious art object. What is the nature of the object then?
You know, once when I was, I think I was a teenager at the time, I saw this marvelous art piece by Alison Knowles. She's a member of Fluxus. And it was called The Big Book, my memory says. And it was a huge, huge book up to the ceiling of the room. And you walked in and the pages were open. The pages went all around. And you walked into each page and each page was a different sort of art realm. You know, one was, I can't remember quite, but it was like lizards or fairy tale time. And I thought, this is what a book should be. It's so many pages. And within all these pages, everything can take place. It's, you know, the open realm of possibilities. And life is so not the open realm of possibilities. You're constantly being told what to do and presented with ugly, you know, whatever ways of having to be. And suddenly, and a book, there are all these awful rules that come from the 19th century without going into analysis about why there are these rules. And they're really boring and they don't have much to do with us anymore and they just cut down possibilities. And if you just open the thing up and said all a book is all these pages, everything can happen.
How did, you know, your techniques have evolved over many, many years. You've been writing as, although you're as old as I am, I think, you've been writing for many more years than I've been alive, it feels like.
I'm an old woman.
But the appropriation technique is a relatively more recent thing, isn't it?
That's something that started with Great Expectations, which I wrote, I think, was that about 81
mm-hmm.
that I wrote that? Yeah. And that it began there. I was very influenced at the time by Bob Ashley's music and his use of appropriated musical texts to create environments.
What were the things other than Great Expectations that get Cuisinarted into Great Expectations?
Ooh, my memory. All right, there's The Story of O. There's Flaubert. That's the second chapter. There's some awful romance novel. I can't remember. It's one of those, you know, very typical romance novels. There's Keats. There's, what did I do for the Propertius? Oh, it's Propertius. Yeah, there's Propertius. That's the end. I don't remember anymore the novel.
Always there's a pornographic war going on in the background of these books. At some point it seems as if the graveyard battlefield becomes the context out of which these things rise. And I've always wondered where you find those texts. You know, they're sort of like, they remind me of the offstage war going on in Genet's The Balcony.
Right.
But I've wondered, you know, where you get them.
Yeah, Genet's certainly one of the people I most identify with. Well, first of all, being published by Grove Press in the early days, I was never paid by Grove Press, or I was paid, you know, sort of. But I did have an understanding with them that I could come in and take all their pornography. And I did.
Is that true?
I would come in literally with a garbage bag and sweep it into the garbage bag.
Uh-huh.
So I have, and even before that, when I lived in San Francisco at one point and I was living with Peter Gordon, he was working in a sex shop. So I took all the porn out of the sex shop. I have a really good collection of pornography.
I wondered, I remember, I hope this is not going to upset you, but I remember that years and years ago, right now, the Kathy actor who's facing me is very cheerful. You're in
yes.
a good mood and fairly happy. But I remember years ago when I would see you in New York and I would think, here comes Kathy. She looks like she's going to whine. Now, I have a question, which is a peculiar one. Could life be any better, or is the human condition such that it is ultimately unimprovable because any constant condition would eventually become boring and rule-bound?
That's a really interesting question. Ah, how nice to have an interesting question. Sorry.
Well, I won't do it again.
All right. Obviously, the human condition is rule-bound, right? I mean, if nothing else, we're ruled by chance and by death, which we don't know, and it's the one thing we do know, that lovely double bind. I do think, there are two very simple answers. Let me start with the two very simple answers. Yes, of course, human life can be improved. I mean, if the riots haven't taught us that, that we're all screaming for improvement, right, on the very simplistic political, social, economic level.
Mm-hmm.
The other simplistic answer is the human condition is the human condition. Why else could I read Greek classics and get something from them?
Mm-hmm.
You know, with all that we know about context and meaning being determined by contexts. And, you know, when you go that many contexts back, if you can still get something from those works, there's obviously something called the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So much for the simplistic answers. I think that, and I'll answer this personally and then go to the political, I think that my life has gotten better. I think that what I used literature to do on the personal level, and I've always, you know, coming out of that early feminism, the personal and the political are one for me. But I have to answer both and put them together. My life was very, very dark, you know, and has gotten relatively lighter as years have gone on. And one reason it's done that is, I don't mean things are easy for me now, but I'm far better able to cope, far more wanting to laugh, to, you know, look for something, I don't know, to keep looking, is that I worked it through literature. I changed myself, you know, by using literature. And I think this process of, I guess for me, when, you know, during the 60s we all ran to Eastern religions, for me the real religion in the West is art. Literature is this practice. And it's the transference of what you're given, if you call it the self, but it's really just the characteristics you're given. It's the transformation of that through the vehicle of the imagination made actual. And it is possible to do. I mean, it's what we work for. I was very moved. Well, I won't go into the story, but Genesis Peorge of Throbbing Gristle and Psychic TV is now exiled in this country. And he recently gave a talk to my class. And in the talk, he talked about that he always thought art was about seeking vision, about enlightenment. And I was very moved by his whole talk, which didn't sound that simple, and thought, that's true. We're really looking to do that. We're not looking – because any change on the personal is change political, and any change in the political is change personal. And we are looking to that. We're not just looking for the Marxist ideal of everybody has enough food, et cetera, et cetera. We're looking for that deep, deep change that works through vision. And yes, so to answer you, yes, I do think there is such a thing as change of the human condition, but that's the actual condition being changed.
Is there an American avant-garde in fiction today?
At the moment?
Yes.
I the word avant-garde would throw me off. I think there's something new is happening in fiction, and I think it's exciting. It's the first time I've seen, I don't know a lot, but I see more and more writers doing something that interests me very deeply. I don't know if it's a movement yet, and I don't know what name to give it.
There seems to have been, it's as if people have been rooting, and so every couple of years there'll be the new narrative or the new formalism. People want a movement, but so far there doesn't seem to be a movement. Who are the writers who are appealing to you right now?
Steve Erickson. I thought Towards the Black Clock was incredible. Stephen Beachy, who I just met.
Oh, you did meet him?
Yes. Oh, he's
good.
Marvelous.
Isn't he terrific? Yeah.
William Vollman, except when William's acting up. Cormac McCarthy is a great. You know, just a great, great writer. Writers like that, I mean, they take incredible chances. They dare to write badly because they're trying so much. There's a fullness there. And it, again, vision would probably be the main. And also not – and of course, Dennis Cooper. I didn't say Dennis because I just escaped my mind. But there's an attempt to really try to understand things, you know, to, you know, wind all different disciplines, philosophy and God knows what, but everything into it so it doesn't become this minor attempt just to tell a little story or tell a little psychological thing, but it becomes something much more. That was terribly said.
but I know what you mean. I'm talking to Kathy Acker, whose books Portrait of an Eye, which is a collection of three of her earlier novels, and In Memoriam to Identity, have been published in paperback by Pantheon recently. I found myself wondering recently, given American experimental writing, you know, not all visionary writing has been decadent writing or despairing writing. Blake, for instance, is ecstatic. And yet when I think about your work, about Dennis's work, it almost feels as if to be an American visionary writer, you have to be willing to plumb the lower depths. Is this a class issue?
For me, the first thing I would say, I do think it's a class issue. Just let me think about that for a second. Because the first thing I'd say for me, though I realize all the writers I just said are men, is that it has to do with being a woman. Because the depths for me personally had to do a lot with the fact of my being female, of being, you know, that having a history behind me that says that I'm defined by my sexual organs. And then having to deal with that sexuality is, so deeply matters to me, yet that sexuality has been so defined by this history.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I'm immediately in a double bind, which is very black. Does it also have to do with class? You know, class in this country is never mentioned, right? So we have an underground called class. It's not as in England where it's mm-hmm. touches the surface of everything. And I think the way class works, and this is a very fast analysis, so I'm thinking fast on this one, is I was taught when I went to school, I went to a private school, and I was taught English history and I was taught English literature. And only at the very end was I allowed to read American books and taught a bit of American history. The reason I was done, and there was a great emphasis on speaking properly and writing properly. This in England, you can see how this works politically in England. Because when you speak properly and you write properly, you're showing that you're part of the upper classes and the upper middle now. You're showing that you were born properly. So to speak properly and to write properly is to be born properly. And elegance, proper irony, the right way of writing a novel all has to do with the speaking and writing properly. That's class. That means that if you come from the lower classes and you don't speak or write properly, you're not able to be part of the ongoing society. You lack the elegance. You might shout too loud. What did Newsweek recently accused Jerry Brown of screaming? I thought that was marvelous, you know, with all the behind that word screaming. I think class, you know, our whole practice of literature, especially of the values of something like the writers for the New York Review of Books, have very deeply to do with class. And that we're in a war, so I say we're, a lot of the writers who dare to do other things besides write properly, besides write elegantly, are in a war, but we've never announced the terms of this war. We've never, I think this is a very interesting question you've asked, because we've never talked about class. We've never announced why we write the way we do in this war about the uses of language.
Well, it's also that, you know, so many times people ask me why the books I particularly recommend seem to be so depressing. And eventually I began to formulate the idea that if you had a certain vision in America, that your alignment had to be with the oppressed, and that the oppressed are in a state of poverty, and that therefore your imagination, the area of your imagination is going to be in the area of the ash from which the phoenix is reborn. It's prior to rebirth.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I mean, Nelson Algren would be one of the heroes of this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Settlement, at least.
Yeah, and so it did begin to seem to me that it is a class issue, in that to write from satedness or completed vision in America would really be to write for no one, whereas, you know, to write from impoverishment or deprivation mm-hmm. is to speak to an enormous audience, not necessarily a reading audience, but an audience that exists and needs the work.
You know, I absolutely agree with you, because when I started writing, most of my friends were poets, and I was closest to the people who are now known as a language school, but there's a sort of elitism there of the materials they use. And I very much wanted to use materials, using other texts, that didn't stink of elitism, so I turned to what are the low-class genres, mm-hmm. mysteries and pornography and things like that. And doing that and working conceptually plus using low-class genres, that's what really upset people. And I know that I use those low-class genres because of the class attitude towards genre.
Hmm. I think it's also, you know, speaking of low-class genres, I think that a metaphor in contemporary fiction, as well as for much of life, is infection. I think that sense comes from Bataille. Certainly,
yes.
You know, a literalization
yes.
of filthiness becomes simply filth, squalor,
right.
and unclosed wounds. People don't like this kind
yes.
of thing. But I do think that infection rather than promulgation, infection is the opposite of consumerism. it spreads without itself being desired.
It's of course. And that probably is allied to Bataille's idea of the potlatch,
yes.
You know, of giving things away, of...
Of contagion.
Yes.
I'm talking to Kathy Acker. You know, Colette's early work was published by her husband under his name, and it is now said that Brecht was not the author of his own plays, that after the first two or three, that a woman wrote most of them.
Is that true?
There's a major book coming out about this. I wondered whether when you write Great Expectations or Don Quixote, are you redressing that kind of wound of a woman taking a man's book and publishing it with her name?
Well, you know, I didn't start doing that consciously at all. My reason for using other texts was I do have this identity or this self that's full of holes,
mm-hmm.
and I need other texts. I'm a totally reactive person. Yes. And I think it's very deep in my sexuality, which not in terms of gender, whether I'm a man or a woman, but it's deep in the kind of passivity that I need these other texts. I mean, I just always act reactively. But more and more as I began doing it, I began being interested in this redressing of the silence of women. And in Memoriam to Identity, I very consciously in that book, I don't know if I'm looking to redress, I think Colette did a very good job herself of redressing that wrong that her first husband had done her. But I'm definitely, for instance, in Memoriam to Identity, I had a real sense, I turned to Faulkner, I was looking for who I considered one of the major American voices, not of the recent novel, but of the novel that had just passed. And it was always Faulkner for me. But I noticed that in his novels, often he has a woman as central character, but she never talks. Mm-hmm. All the men are talking around her. And I wanted to hear her talk. And it was a very simple thing I did. I took The Sound and the Fury of the Wild Palms, where the woman does talk quite a bit more. And why am I blanking out that other book where she doesn't talk?
Temple
yes,
Drake?
Yeah,
Temple Sanctuary.
Of course, because I have the corn cob scene in there.
Mm-hmm.
And Temple, never, you don't really hear her version of it.
Mm. In fact, she has a fish mouth and she's always running.
Yes.
Yeah. She never lingers long enough.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, it's sort of funny because one of the first things said to her in that book is, "I seen your name where it'd been written on the bathroom wall." I thought, you know, this is a very kind of Kathy accusation. What are you working on now? What's the new book called?
It's called My Mother Demonology. My Mother Colon Demonology. And the narrator is Laure Colette Pagnot, who was associated with Bataille at the end of her life.
Do you have any sense of generation? You know, a lot of people see experimental and visionary literature as being endpoints, you know,
right.
Termination points. But it seems to me, at any rate, that the writing that you, Kathy Acker, are doing, or Dennis Cooper, is sort of very generative writing, that a lot of young writers and young readers are being inspired by this, and that a new literary culture, an anti-literary, mm-hmm. anti-culture is being formed. Do you have any final feelings about that?
Yeah, two feelings. One is that I very much feel part of both community and lineage. I don't think writers write alone. I think we write out of lineage and community, and I'm very strong feeling of what my lineage is, which is sort of beginning with Rimbaud, going through Genet, Burroughs, ending up, it is a male-dominated lineage, but that's where I situate myself, and ending up with, you know, I mean, not ending up, but I mean at the moment, you know, with Dennis, with Stephen Beachy, with other writers that I feel very close to. I certainly don't have a feeling that it's at an end. You know, like you, I feel something's beginning. And I very much would hope, I never thought about this anti-literary culture, but I very much would hope that is what's beginning, because literary smacks to me of the old class ethics, you know, the upper class ethics that were dominated by this old idea from England of class. And I like very much, and everyone's screaming, oh, books are over. I don't think books could ever be over, because it's one of the few media nowadays that's not totally regulated by money. You mm-hmm. don't need a lot of money to write a book, and you really don't need much money to print books. I mean, distribution on a large scale is difficult, but if you lose that, you just take your garbage sack, you stick your books in it, you know, that you've persuaded some offset person, or now with laptop, it's even easier to get up for you, and you go around to the bookstores. I mean, it's always a revolutionary act at bottom, this business of printing books. And it's fabulous, you know, when now more and more writers on the commercial scene are not writing politically. I don't know if it's more and more. Maybe they never have. So what they're doing, and not writing sexually, what they're doing is, dare I say this on radio, some awful FBI man might be listening, but they're doing it in graphic novels, where I find fabulous, you know, work, political and sexual, going on in graphic novels. I mean, it just appears anywhere. Youth culture is a wonderful thing. It'll pop up with it all the time. And I love this, you know, if you call, like, graphic novels anti-literary, I love that. I love where all these things can keep popping up in different places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always sort of wondered, you know, because they talk about literary culture, and it seems always that the most exciting place in literary culture is in the anti-literary and in the anti-cultural. And it's sort of as if there is a hunger for culture always to subsume its most dissident elements.
Yeah, I think so.
Are you subsumable?
I am willing to be subsumed. I've never been a purist. Any, if it reeks of money, I'll do it if it's not too right-wing, but no one's ever tried to subsume me.
I've been talking to Kathy Acker, the author of In Memoriam to Identity, recently published in paperback by Pantheon, as well as the Portrait of an Eye, a collection of three earlier texts, well known for her book Blood and Guts in High School, which made everyone aware of her, as opposed to what had previously been the self-chosen few. I've been happy to have you on my show, Kathy.
Oh, it's been great. I thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of ice and snow in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold in books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse Club.